And you cannot impede a legislator getting to the Capitol.
Oh, yes.
So far be it from me.
Good morning, everyone. We're convening today's Revenue Committee meeting. I'm sorry for the chair being a little late. We are going to take our agenda a little out of order. Our respected co-speaker is here with a bill, and he has someplace he has to be shortly, so I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2504 and invite co-speaker Hannah to come forward and talk about this bill.
Good morning, colleagues. Happy St. Patrick's Day to those of you who went with the green. I'm appreciative as an ancestor of the country. My name is Bruce Hanna. I'm a state representative from House District 7, which is down in Roseburg. I represent rural parts of Lane and Douglas County. I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning and for your patience and willingness to move around a little bit to keep schedules working. I'm proud to bring to you this morning House Bill 2504 and your consideration of this bill. We all know it's no secret that health care costs are rising, continue to rise, and that rise is dramatic. The average individual or family health insurance plan in Oregon and around the country range from $140 a month to $1,300 per month. Currently, there are 193,000 Oregonians who purchase their own individual or family insurance plan. When you include the 21,000 individuals who have lost group health and choose to buy a portability plan, and nearly 16,000 additional individuals in the government's high-risk pool, you have more than 230,000 individuals who do not receive coverage through their employer or a government program. Again, at a cost between $140 a month for a young, healthy individual to a cost of $1,300 a month or more for a family, the cost of self-coverage for health insurance can be onerous. Individuals and families are simply faced with a very difficult choice: pay or have no coverage for care. Further, as you know, through discussions with the federal government, we have seen an individual mandate made on all Americans, and adding to the mandate for that care is an individual or a punitive tax if you are not covered. Beginning in January of 2014, that tax will be $190 for two adults. It grows to $650 for two adults in 2015, and by 2016, that cost or tax will be $1,390 for two adults. I believe we should be doing all we can to incentivize health insurance coverage for Oregonians. We're all aware of the savings to health and to the system when people have health insurance and get health care, but if our only approach is to say either fork over thousands of dollars per year or take your chances on health care and pay a penalty, I don't believe we're establishing good policy. This bill is simple. It encourages individuals and families to purchase health insurance and deduct the cost of that insurance from their taxable income. I believe if the government is going to mandate coverage, then we have a responsibility to help Oregonians meet that requirement. Legislatures around the country, including ours, love to talk about or balk at unfunded mandates, those laws that require us at the state level to do something or provide something, but don't help us with the resources to do so. It's a good argument. But here we can do something to help. And at no point has this been more necessary than in a time when our state unemployment still lingers at the 10% mark or higher. And I can tell you, as a business owner and provider of health care to my employees, it is becoming more and more difficult and more costly to provide that care. I would encourage your committee to take a close look at House Bill 2504. And encourage you to join me in supporting a common sense solution for Oregonians that this bill may provide. Thank you, co-chairs.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Hannah? Thank you for
thank
coming.
Thank you for allowing me to come early.
And I appreciate it. I in respect to you getting out of here on time, I have not had our staff, which we normally do talk about this bill. So at this time, Chris, you want to talk about how this fits into our current structure? And
Sure. In addition to the description that the co-speaker provided, I guess what I would add there is that the language also disallows a deduction if for the same expenses if taken at the federal level through itemized deductions or at the state level through the elderly medical deduction. In either of those cases, it's possible that some share of these expenses are currently being deducted under those small groups. Those aren't all taxpayers. They would have to be, for the elderly medical subtraction, they would have to meet those requirements, which would be age 62 and over, and paying some health insurance there, as well as under the general medical deduction, if expenses exceed 7.5% of their AGI, then they can deduct some portion of that. The language in the bill just makes sure there isn't a double deduction there.
Got it.
It clarifies that they can't claim it in two places.
But they can. This would be a straight-up claim, and then in these other provisions, they may. That doesn't change those provisions. It just means they can't do it twice.
Right.
Yes, just one point of clarification. Thank you, Madam Chair. If this bill does go forward, regarding the double deduction, we need to make sure, I haven't looked at the details on this, that if a taxpayer is subject to AMT, then they have to meet the 10% threshold, not 7.5%. So we need to make sure then that they get the proper deduction in that case.
Mm-hmm. Representative, welcome to the Revenue Committee. We never let anything go. We immediately get into the weeds of complex tax policy.
Madam Co-Chair, if I may, we spent a fair amount of time trying to get this right.
I see
understanding
that you did.
That you all are dealing with issues, and when I hear the representative whose profession is as a certified public accountant immediately come up with points, you know what it's like to try to draft a piece of legislation to get all the details right. There are some unanswered questions, but our attempt here was not to have duplicity, mm-hmm. to stay away from that where we could figure it out. There may be some details to be dealt with there. The idea is that there are a huge group of Oregonians who on their own are required to buy health insurance. Basically, this gives them the same incentive that a business would have in deductibility.
Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Hannon? No? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have any others to signed up to?
There's nobody.
Okay. Anyone else like to speak on this bill before I close it? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2504, and I am going to open a public hearing on H.J.R. 14. Friends, this was carried over from yesterday, and Representative Gelser, would you like to speak on this?
Yes, I would. I would like to.
Paul, she's preparing, do you want to give us a sort of flyover?
Okay. H.J.R. 14 is a constitutional amendment, and what it does is change the property tax limits as they apply to schools. There's a couple of changes. You can see them all very clearly on the in the bill. There's a sub B, and under a section 11B would be modified. It retains the current Measure 5 rates for other than schools at $10, and then it maintains the school system down to $5, and then makes a modification for common school districts or union high school districts, in other words, K-12, and raises that rate limit to $650 per thousand of real market value. And one of the things that has been a very distinct phenomenon over the last 3 years is the rise in property tax rates relative to market value, because market value has fallen so dramatically. So if you look at the school's tax rate relative to market value, it's gone from $3.44 2 years ago to our preliminary numbers now for 10-11 is to $4.22. And so if you add the other education components, ESDs and community colleges, We're very close to the $5 now because of the fall in market value, and that means additional compression. The other thing that it does is it establishes a 750 local option, maintains the double majority requirements, says that Section 11 does not apply to taxes. In this paragraph, Section 11 is Measure 50, and then it establishes the rule that any revenue raised above the permanent rates, which are currently about $4.64 per thousand of assessed value, those would not be counted in the distribution formula. They would be retained by the local district.
Okay. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's nice to see all of your smiling St. Patrick's Day faces from the side of the dais. I am Sarah Gelser, State Representative from Corvallis. It's fortuitous that we have this bill today after we heard testimony yesterday from some very bright school children who talked to you about the challenges of what they perceive to be inadequate resources in their schools. And I can assure you that this is a challenge that children are grappling with both in their charter schools and their local public schools. And by way of introduction, wanted to tell you a little story from my family. We have four children in our local public schools, two elementary school students, a middle schooler, and a high school student. And every year since my oldest child, who's now in high school, began kindergarten at our local elementary school, this time of year we get a letter home talking about the budget reductions for the next year. And parents are surveyed in terms of what it is that we would like to reduce. The two youngest girls are now fourth and fifth graders, and they had the sheet in the back. And amongst them, they were debating what was more important, music, art, PE, or technology. And the one girl said, well, I love music, it's really fun, but if we eliminate art, we won't have any at all. And the other girl said, technology is really important because I'll need that when I grow up and get a job. We can't get rid of technology. And it was just heartbreaking to me to listen to a 9 and 10-year-old really trying to balance what is it that's most important to them, and to know as a parent that we already are purchasing some of those services for them through our local PTO. We contribute every year, other families do, and we purchase FTE in the school. There's other schools in our district that are actually buying math teachers and other types of teachers. And this is in Corvallis that has one of the higher property tax rates in the state. We have exercised the local option levy. Our local option levy pays for one out of five teachers in our school district. It's 20% of our local operating budget, and we have to go out years, which is quite challenging. What HJR 14 does or attempts to do is provide more tools to local communities to decide how they want to finance their local schools and how they want to build on our equalization formula to make sure that kids have what they need. It also attempts to give districts that still have plenty of room under the cap to be able to assess property taxes in their community and not be punished for doing that. Statewide, the permanent property tax rate under Measure 50, and that's kind of a relic that's set up in Measure 50, this permanent property tax rate. It ranges from as low as $1 per thousand in some districts to $5.50 per thousand in other districts, which then would fall under compression, which means that depending on where you live in the state, even though some communities have less total property property value capacity in their communities, their citizens may be paying less on a same value home than someone in your district, for instance. So one person living in a $200,000 home, their family may pay $1 per thousand on that $200,000 home, while someplace else is paying $4.50 per thousand on a $200,000 home. But they both benefit under the same equalization formula, which means those paying that $450 on that $200,000 home are sending money out to other districts across the state that are not contributing as much. Now, even though under our current system, those districts that have that very low property rate, tax rate, could increase what they are levying on their local citizens to improve resources for schools, there's no incentive to do so. Because if they raise that rate in their local community, it simply goes to the equalization formula. So you go to your local taxpayers and say, we want to increase your local property tax rate, but it's not going to make any measurable difference that you can see in our local school district, because this increase will just count against what's coming to you from the state. So what HDR 14 does is try to address all of those issues, first of all, by raising the total cap to $7.50. The first thing that that will do is pull school districts out of compression all across the state. Almost every single district in the state will benefit from this. My own district currently loses $500,000 each year, or $1 million a biennium, just to compression. If the voters passed this measure immediately, these properties would come out of compression because it would lift above that $5. The second thing is that it would allow districts to raise that permanent property tax rate and keep every penny that they raise right there in their local school district, just like they do with the local option levy. And what this bill would do is allow local school boards to do that up to $6.50. So a local school board looking at the programs and the needs in their district can say, we want to invest in an innovation program. We want to start this new charter school. We need the resources to do this. Voters, this is how we plan to do it. Hold us as your locally elected school board members accountable for doing that. If they want to go beyond $6.50, they would then need to go out for a local option levy like they do right now in that space between $6.50 and $7.50. There's also important policy consequences to this bill as well. I chair the Education Committee, and we spend a lot of time in hearings like the one that you heard yesterday. And what is frustrating in education policy at the state level is that we have no lack of passion and no lack of really good ideas about how to educate kids in the state of Oregon. What we do have a lack of is the finances to back up those ideas and put them into place. So what you have is a competition between a lot of really good ideas for very scarce resources to serve a very diverse group of kids across the state. And so when someone comes to our committee with an innovation proposal or a new way of paying teachers or a new way of doing professional development or a new way of teaching math, it's very difficult for the state to say, this worked well in this one community, so we're going to require every single community in the state to do it because it worked well here. And we may or may not give you the money to do it. With this legislation, we give individual communities the ability to invest in programs and policies and initiatives that will benefit their own individual students. We are going to increase the quality and the interest in running for our local school boards, because all of a sudden we restore the power of the local school board and those local elected officials to actually make policies for their kids. Right now, our local school boards don't have much power. They don't have much control. They negotiate contracts with the dollars that we send them. They implement the mandates that we send to them and don't fund, and they just try to keep their heads above water. All of a sudden, when they have taxing authority again, the voters pay attention to who they're sending there. More people are interested in running, and we can hold them accountable. They can actually invest in these programs to look at improving outcomes in student achievement. Finally, because local districts would be able to invest even under, I mean, most of these would still fall under the current $5 cap in Measure 5, we would be re-infusing money into our K-12 system. Since the passage of Measure 5 and 50, if we had continued our tax rates as a percentage of personal income or just at that same, you know, same basic rate, no drastic increases, we would have roughly today $6 billion of additional revenue in our system to pay for K-12 schools. When right now we look at climbing a mountain to get to $5.8 billion statewide for our K-12 schools, $5.8 billion, to think about $6 billion left sitting on the table is mind-boggling. And it doesn't just impact those kids. It impacts all of the budget discussions that we have here, because not only did we pull that $6 billion out of schools, when we pulled that out, we put our schools in direct competition with public safety, with human services, with all of the other critical programs that we need to pay for in our budget. This allows schools to open that lever again, to really start to try to fix our school financing system, and to allow communities to demonstrate their values and their desires for their kids by investing. Finally, colleagues, this measure is a constitutional referral. It allows us to have a conversation with voters. And I believe that whatever the outcome at the ballot, this is an important conversation for us to have with our voters. I don't know about all of you, but the issue I hear most about from my constituents in my district and all across the state is school funding. It is time for us to have a frank and open conversation with our voters and the people of Oregon about how we have undermined our school financing system and ask them if they trust themselves, if we trust our communities, if we trust our school boards, if we trust our voters to make appropriate financial and educational decisions for their local schools. Right now, our Constitution prevents them from doing that. Our equalization formula prevents them from doing that. This bill restores that power. It preserves a basic equalization formula, and it finally frees our local communities to do what they should be doing best, making decisions for their own kids in their own communities and holding their own local schools accountable. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Representative, questions? Yes.
Thank you. You mentioned that, the shortfall as a result of Measure 550. It sounds like it would about double the school funding budget. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, I think you have to look at what the potential is and what would actually happen. There's a capacity in there. Individual communities are going to have to make these choices. You would, I think the number I got from Paul the other day, statewide in 9-10, what was under compression statewide was $65 million. So upon the passage of this, you would have, $65 million like that coming out of compression into our K-12 schools. Anything beyond that would have to be a decision that was proactively made by locally elected officials or local voters in a local community.
Could I follow up?
Yes, please.
Yeah, you actually answered the second question, the question I hadn't asked yet, but that's fine. What I'm really interested in understanding is how you picked these particular numbers, and I believe that these numbers are not really going to handle the current crisis in school funding, and even if they were adopted across the state, which of course, as you acknowledge, isn't going to happen. So how did you pick these particular numbers?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question. There were two thoughts that went into picking the numbers. Numbers often are somewhat arbitrary. I tried to make them unarbitrary. The first was thinking about what could we tolerate in terms of a number under the total tax rate. The second was looking at what would be fair and what would give tools to districts that already were locked in by Measure 5 and 50 at a relatively higher tax rate. If we kept it at the $5 cap, and we gave districts that ability to raise above their permanent rate, you see, and keep that in their districts without going to the equalization formula, districts like Lake Oswego, Corvallis, they would have no room to benefit from that. And that's really where the equalization is still protected in this. A community like Corvallis really doesn't have much room to grow under this because they're already so close to their $5 cap. A rural county that's closer to $1 per thousand, they theoretically would have, $7 or $6.50 to grow. So you've still protected how far they can grow. But we built the numbers to be able to give all districts some latitude to be able to grow and make some investment in their district. If you didn't increase it, you would be shortchanging districts like Corvallis and Lake Oswego, who have so generously been contributing to the rest of the state in Portland. And I would point out one more time, Corvallis, which is the district that I represent, and Philomath, the other school district that I represent, are among the lowest per ADMW what they get back, even though Corvallis is one of the highest rates. And Corvallis has had to cut its budget every single year since 1990, except for the 2007-2008 school year, closing multiple schools, and it came up yesterday. I don't know any of our schools that have a nurse.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm still trying to get at the main point, and I think I'll just say it and see if you agree with me. This measure, assuming it were adopted, would not deal with the school funding crisis, would it? I mean, it would allow some school districts to raise a few dollars more. But it doesn't deal with the fact that our schools are very seriously underfunded now. The amounts that you can raise with this measure are just too small, aren't they?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, the passage of this bill and the approval of this measure at the ballot in itself would not solve the school funding crisis. However, it would give local communities the tools to partner with the state in making significant gains on our funding in K-12 schools. There is substantial capacity within this to increase the contribution from local communities to their local schools. Even in a district like mine where we're so close to that $5 cap, this would be extraordinary for us. Our local school board on its own could determine to renew its local option levy and not have to go back out and then talk to the voters about going beyond that. They could exercise the full capacity of their local option levy. Right now, they lose a lot of that due to compression. Portland Public Schools testified in the House Education Committee earlier this week. Their local option capacity is something like $168 million, but the Measure 50 limits limit what they can collect to about $58 million because of the complications of the formula. So this is, will it completely solve the problem just by passage? No. But it restores power in local districts and gives them the ability to not have to depend on us to turn around in state school funding formula the increases that they need. We empower them to partner with us to provide what is needed for students. We're still going to have to do our part. It doesn't let us off the hook, but it means that, that they aren't stuck out there in the middle of the ocean without help while we struggle through this economy.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Pence.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The I really appreciate your thinking on this. It's a complex matter and deserves a great deal of thought, and so I'm appreciative of your efforts. The concern, it seems to me, when this matter goes out to the voter is the belief by many folks, particularly I'm sure in all our districts, but in mine for sure, is that we're not using the money we're getting appropriately, and thus many have the excuses we hear about either PERS or about health care or about other things that they believe the money currently that's going to schools is being misspent upon. So how would you suggest that that lack of credibility be addressed, and how would you actually propose to go to the older citizens in Oregon and say, oh, by the way, we're going to give school districts the power to raise your taxes. We don't think you've been paying enough, and you need to pay more. How are you going to make that argument? Then I know there's two questions there, but I appreciate your thinking on that.
That is two questions. Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Bence. On the first question, that is one of the things I like most about this proposal is that it attempts to address voter skepticism with the legislature and the state by restoring this authority and accountability to locally elected school board members. And I think that many people, when they look at money that's going to schools or money that's going to the state, they worry about decisions that we make at the state level. This legislation would ensure that every dollar that would be raised under this model would stay within a local school district. And if you were to go back and look at the contracts that local school boards are negotiating with their staff, they are working very collaboratively with them. You are seeing very difficult decisions being made around health care, around PERS pickups, around retirement packages and incentives. And all of that is very transparent and easy for community members to access. And again, it's going to increase that interest in who they are sending to their local school boards in order to make these decisions. In terms of the second question, I think, again, who is going to use this and how it is going to be used is going to be based on who is living in local communities and what it is that they are choosing to invest in their kids. And I think that the flip question of why should I pay more on my property taxes could be flipped to, you know, why should a 9-year-old have to choose between music and whether or not they're going to have the technology they need to be able to compete in a world economy? Those are really the tensions that we have to deal with. Both good questions, both challenging issues, but issues that I think are best dealt with at the local level by locally elected school board members and local voters.
Paula?
Yes.
Thank you. It's having reviewed where the money is going, it appears that a great deal of this is going either to schools or to medical care, which we heard about earlier this morning, the challenges that face folks to pay for health insurance premiums. And it seems to me that the older folks that are going to be asked to vote on this measure are going to be looking at those two costs and saying to themselves, gosh, is a choice between medical care on the one hand or kids on the other? How do you propose that we help them in that challenging choice?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, I think particularly if you're looking at older voters and older property owners that are seniors in the state of Oregon, they have a series of unique tools to help them with their medical expenses. First, the only Oregonians that are entitled to universal health care coverage are seniors under Medicare. The second is Oregon is the only state in the nation to have a very generous senior medical deduction, which, and I know we're going to talk more about that on Friday, but the costs of that program are also undermining our ability to provide services for our kids. So I think we really have to create a balance between all ages of our population. But if we go back to the comments that Representative Juan made yesterday about the need to invest in our economy, invest in jobs, grow our economy, and grow our revenues, unless we are investing in our kids and improving our schools, we're not going to be able to reach those goals. And right now, we are not setting our kids up for success given the resources that we're plowing into those schools. I think the last thing that I would point out is if you have a local district that is going out for levy, and again, I know my district best. We all know our own districts best. But in Corvallis, we had a very difficult time. It was a very difficult campaign to pass our first local option levy. What that school district did when they went out was say, we're going to be very accountable with these dollars and show you exactly what we plan to spend them on. They report every year exactly how they have spent those levy dollars. They did what you talked about, Representative Juan, and mapping out those expenditures over the course of 5 years. So there was a reserve in each of the four years to pick up the roll-up cost from year to year. And when that district went back out for its renewal, it was able to show that every penny that they asked for was spent in precisely the way that they had said. That's something that's very difficult to do at a state level when you are running money across a whole state, but that is something that a local district can do when they say, we're going to raise the property tax by a quarter in order to invest in literacy coaches to make sure that every third grader is reading by the end of the third grade. And I think those are the kinds of results that voters will feel good about and will make them pleased with the actions that their school boards have taken and the investments that they're making in their schools.
Thank you.
Representative
One. Thank you, Mr. Madam Chair. So I'm interested in this concept of the school district being able to vote for their own higher taxes and then keep the money there. And how is this not just another instance of the wealthiest neighborhoods and the wealthiest school districts in big cities changing the rules of the game for their own benefit and to the detriment of other areas that are not as economically advantaged as they are, and creating a two-tiered education system in our state?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Wand. Thank you for that question. It's a very good one. Right now, we have an equalization formula that attempts to address that. And unfortunately, equalization is in the eye of the beholder. I think that we can all agree that regardless of where a student lives in the state of Oregon, they should have access to a comprehensive, quality public education. Unfortunately, due to our school financing system right now, we can't guarantee that to any of our kids, whether they're in a traditional public school or a charter school. This legislation does not change our equalization formula at all. It freezes in place our current equalization formula so that a wealthy district like mine or like Oswego will continue to contribute disproportionately more to the state school funding formula to be redistributed across the state to districts that have less property tax capacity in their communities in order to serve those kids. The only thing that this does is allows those communities to be able to invest a little bit more in their kids. If you were to look at this, at the reductions and cuts that have taken place across the state, those districts, the wealthiest districts, have been those that have had to take the most dramatic cuts in the years since 1990. Corvallis is frequently considered to be one of the wealthiest districts in the state. When I served on that school board, we closed four schools in a district that had 13 schools at the time. Those are devastating reductions. The other way that the equity is preserved is you still have a limit on how much these individual communities can raise under this new formula because they still have that cap, and their capacity, because of how high they already are, is much lower than that is much lower than a district that is currently contributing less. And while it is true that some communities have less capacity in their property tax base, they still are not they are not drawing equitably. And the issue isn't, is someone who has a $1 million home paying more than someone that has a $50,000 home. The question is, why should there be a $4 differential between a taxpayer with the same income and two taxpayers with the same income, both of whom are living in $200,000 homes in different parts of the state, and one is sending a big chunk of their property tax to somebody else's school district? This helps to address some of that.
Just a quick follow-up comment. Thank you for that. That's a very good answer. And one of the things I'd like to send out as a reminder is that for folks that are in rural areas, taking AP calculus or a different language than happens to be offered in their school district is almost completely impossible. But there is a solution that exists, and it's in the virtual charter schools. They can go online and they can take some of those classes from a rural area, from their homes, and have better equity, and it's cheaper.
And Madam Chair, if I may, that's an excellent point, Representative Wand, and we are working on legislation in the House Education Committee that not only preserves the option for online learning through our statewide online schools, but it also encourages our districts, because this is a great solution for our rural districts, for local districts as well, to be able to develop hybrid models that allow students to pick, not have to enroll just full-time, but be able to pick that Mandarin class or that calculus class and really be more efficient with the technology that we have to give them access to high-demand, low-incidence classes and credit recovery programs as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to follow up on Representative Walsh, I mean, Wands. and on the second page, paragraph D, it says, taxes imposed in the subsection in excess of the permanent rate shall not be. So isn't his point correct, that if we don't take those into account, that inequity is a high probability, or is there some other element of the formula that would prevent that from happening?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Benz. That applies only to this new rate, what's above the permanent property tax rate as of today. So let's say, make up a school district. Elwood School District is currently at $4.50 per thousand, and under this, they decide to raise theirs to $4.85. That 35 cents, that new 35 cents, is not subject to the state school funding formula. That initial $4.50, it still goes into the state school funding formula as it does today. It's only the new dollars that are not subject to the state school funding formula, but everything else still is. So the lion's share of what they are paying will still be subject to the state school funding formula and the equalization. The other place that you get the equalization is a district that currently has a rate of $1. They have a capacity to increase for their district $6.50. A district that is currently at $5, they only have a capacity to move within $2.50 and only $1.50 without going to voters.
Yes, I think I got that.
The matter is sufficiently complex. I'm going to have to go back and sketch it out to make sure I understand it. It still strikes me that it does allow the more wealthy parts of the state to enjoy a higher opportunity for their kids, kind of like what we heard yesterday in an odd parallel. But so I'll go back and study it some more.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, if I may quickly, it's not that they can enjoy a higher standard for their kids. It's that they have the ability, after they have sent the majority of their property tax dollars out to other parts of the state, to start to try to get their ADM similar to where some of these other parts of the state are, so that they can offer similar resources to what's happening in other parts of the state, even though they're already paying more.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'll simply say the matter is sufficiently complex. It's going to require a lot of work, and I appreciate the work you've done thus far, and I hope to someday enjoy the same level of understanding that you enjoy today.
I think that Representative Gelser would be happy to help you with that. Representative Barnhart, you had.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a very, very complex subject, what happened, of course, at the beginning of this, of equalization, was that some districts that had been significantly underfunded were funded at a much higher level.
That's right.
For a while. But eventually, we got to the point where every district was suffering cuts because the number of dollars available in the total system was simply not enough to pay for K-12 schools, universities, community colleges, the health system the state's responsible for, Measure 11, and on and on. I mean, it simply wasn't enough to do that. And so even the districts that were poorly funded at the beginning came up for a while, have been on the decline now for at least a decade. And you just said something that I hadn't understood before at all, and I think it's important to emphasize it, and that is that this also allows districts that have had very low property tax rates to unlock the potential for an increase for their local kids. So it actually, this proposal may actually benefit districts with very low locked-in property tax rates more than districts with locked-in high property tax rates, if I understand the proposal well. So a district with a rate of a dollar, for example, could end up with a rate still substantially less than the rate in your district, but raise substantially more money in the process of per child in the process of dealing with it. I mean, there's several different items in this equation. One is the number of dollars of property per child in a district.
Yes.
That's certainly an issue, and that's the one that several of us have been talking about. But you're talking about a different issue,
yes,
which is the rate at which that property is taxed.
Yes.
So you could easily have a district with a very large number of dollars of property per child in the district taxed at a very low rate. A very small increase in taxes could make a very substantial difference in the number of dollars available to the district in which that property exists. That hadn't occurred to me until you said it a minute ago, and I think it's important to emphasize that this proposal may actually benefit low-tax districts more than it does high-tax districts.
Mr. Chair, you're precisely right, and the important second piece to that is that their small increase in a small district proportional to the dollars per student is substantial, but it will not undermine what they are getting through the state school equalization formula, through their small school funds,
right,
through their through any of those additional funds for rural schools.
And if I could just follow up, that's the key to this.
Yes.
Because the money stays local. Right now, there is absolutely no incentive at all,
exactly,
for a district with a low tax rate to raise the tax rate, because that money under the current law gets spread across the state. There would be no reason for them to go to try to raise the local property tax. On the other hand, if this rule is applied, if your proposal is applied, then they get to keep the dollars that they raise locally.
Absolutely. That is precisely it.
One more point.
That makes a big difference to me. I hadn't understood that issue at all.
One more point on to dovetail on that. The opposite,
yeah,
is also true. And my particular district, this district, was traditionally underfunded before Measure 5, and in equalization gained a lot because we have a lot of students, but a very small tax base because our main industry is not taxed.
That's right.
And so proportionately,
right,
the taxpayers were not crazy about raising their taxes because it would be a significant bump for them. And this is what one of the things that got us here, and I'm very sensitive to getting, you know, this equalization piece right, because Salem-Keizer under the changes was considerably advantaged because we couldn't pass a tax increase locally, because the taxpayers took such a huge hit. And I appreciate that discussion. With that, I think we'll get you off the hook, Representative, and ask some folks. Fred Yates, would you like to come forward? You were here yesterday and again today, so we appreciate your, and we saw you here all day yesterday. So if you'd like to speak.
I thank you very much. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Members of the committee, my name is Fred Yates. I'm from Linn County. I represent Americans for Prosperity across the state, basically, on this issue. But first, I am so totally frustrated in all the processes that go on here, and I'm going to try to skip them, but this is the first time in my experiences of coming here I've ever heard a two-way conversation, but it was with her, who is a colleague of yours. Basically, I sat here and rail against all of you with my questions, and there really should be directed to you. They should be directed at the sponsors of the bill, okay? And so it's a one-way conversation. That's not what the founders envisioned for our country. No way, shape, or form. It was supposed to be represented. We should be able to talk back and forth, okay? I think I can speak for a lot of people sitting behind me. We were pleased to see all the puzzled looks across your faces as she tried to explain her way through this labyrinth of things, okay? And it's so complex that you that deal with it don't even understand it. So how do you expect us poor senior voters to be able to understand what's going on here? This is like the IRS tax code. It's so complex that nobody can begin to understand it. It needs to be ripped asunder and placed back, okay? I mean, we got the $1, we got the $5, we got the $2.50, we got the $6.50, we got the $7.50. You can keep this part, you can get rid of that part. That doesn't work. We can't understand it. The voters can't comprehend it. It's too complex. And what we see is we're being taxed out of existence. We do not have infinitely deep pockets. And all my comments from yesterday and most of my three-page diatribe, I guess I want to call it, basically don't count because this is a really fundamental problem. You know, our school system is so broke, and I'm talking not money, I'm talking about an intellectual property. Oregon ranks in the low 40s in the United States. Our Board of Education could not even write a grant for funding. Okay. Does that say how broke everything is? This is wrong. Okay. And Representative Geisler said this is a fortuitous that these two bills came up next to each other. No, I think it's ironical. Because what happens is here's a bunch of children pleading for the money that they should have had that they're being denied, and yet today we're talking about raising the taxes some more. That's ironical, not fortuitous. The money follows the child, okay? And the biggest single problem I see is basically we have out-of-control spending across the entire board, but especially when it comes to the districts and teachers and everything else. The school boards are being held ransom by the unions, okay? We look for you to lower spending, not increase spending, and this is increasing spending. And I think I'll just stop there. Thank you so very much, and I'll answer any question you have.
Any questions? I would like to comment briefly, if I could, Fred, on your comment about our dialogue with our... We often have dialogue with proposers of legislation that comes before us. The proponents of legislation are invited to come in first and to speak to their proposals. It is your right and your privilege to come in and counter whatever argument she makes, and I welcome you to do it. But Representative Gelser is an expert in this field, and it is her proposal, so that dialogue, I think, is very appropriate. And Mr. Co-Speaker, as you saw earlier, came in and made his proposal, and a dialogue with him or anyone else who comes forward with a proposal. It doesn't have to be the legislative member. So I guess I feel that this process, which, you know, may have its complexities, as does our tax code, I welcome you to come forward and criticize any proposal before us in this public forum. And I would note that within our packet are other critics of this proposal. We have been handed written material that references your argument that on taxation, and it has been noted and read
and is part of the permanent record. So I thank you for coming, and I'm a little unhappy that you feel that you don't get a chance to make arguments, and I'd be willing to talk to you at any time in my office about changes that you think would make it more equitable. But this is our process to bring it before public on the internet meeting. Thank you.
I thank you for your comments.
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes.
Very briefly, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I've been receiving emails from our fellow Oregonians talking about this particular proposal. And as a general proposition, I read my emails. I get them on my iPhone at home at night. Sometimes after the kids are asleep, the phone will start going and I'll read them. And I have an open-door policy in my office. I meet a lot of people that I agree with, and I meet a lot of people that I disagree with. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that I was troubled by some of the emails that I was receiving. You know, they were questioning my intelligence and questioning how well I think and questioning whether I'm paying any attention. And there wasn't really any regard given to whether I was the sponsor of this proposal, whether I agree with this proposal, whether Representative Gelser and I spar with each other on issues like this. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that from Representative Gelser to myself, we're all thoughtful people here, even when we disagree. We're all trying our best to do a difficult job. There's not a single unintelligent person in the body. And it would be helpful to state your point well and with passion, but reduce the amount of attacks. Because, again, we really are. This is a group of 60 folks. We've given up a lot of time from our families. Some of us have given up some opportunities elsewhere and other things to do, and we're really trying our best. So I just wanted to put that out on the record. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Yes, you may.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate what you say, and that's why I started with, I rail at you, but it's not really you. Okay, and my passion is that we, the people, don't see anything changing here. We just keep seeing rates go up, 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 and up. And so we have to ask these questions, and they're not fair questions. Yeah, I realize you understand that we're in a recession. We're about to have double-digit inflation, whether you think so or not. I mean, that's my personal opinion. And I understand all these things, but it just seems to be broke because all we see coming out of the entire legislature, not just you, is increases and no decreases. And I thank you so much, and I thank you for the time that all of you spend. I realize that. This is one of the other big problems, is you are so busy that we don't have much time to see you. Representative Gelser asked me to see her yesterday, and we would take something offline. I went upstairs, and her aide said, I'm sorry, she's busy for the next 2 days. There's no time you can see her. And I understand. I mean, out of this meeting, you go to the next meeting, and I'll quit. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Fred, for coming, and thank you for this discussion. You're right. We're busy. But remember, this is a citizen legislature, and I doubt if you'd like to pay us more and have more of our time spent here.
Actually, I didn't even want you to have to come next year.
I get that. Thank you. All right. Lori Wimmer and Holly Fifield signed up yesterday, and on deck is David Williams and Morgan Allen and T.A. Barnhart, just so you know. And then anyone else who would like to speak, please sign up now, and we'll get to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association, and also representing David Williams, who is winging his way to Washington,
okay,
D.C., and asked me to say for the record that Portland Public Schools supports HJR 14 as well. And that's why I'm here today on behalf of the 45,000 members of the Oregon Education Association. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Gelser for her brilliantly thought-out resolution as well as testimony this morning, and to the committee for hearing it and putting up with us all. I'd like to make this simple. You have my written testimony, which I submitted yesterday. But I'd like to point out that since the $5 cap on schools took effect in 1995, in that 16-year period of time, I checked with Legislative Revenue Office, and inflation for the general price levels since that time has been 45%. So that makes it pretty simple for you. This proposal, if the voters were to accept it in the next general election, would simply raise an increment of 30%. So the value of the $5 has slipped by that much inflation, that 45% inflation in the 16 years, and this very modest proposal makes up only two-thirds of that inflation level. So that puts it in perspective in terms of the previous testimony about rates going up and up and up, hardly. I would also point out that the value of a dollar, in addition to the value of the dollar falling, you've heard from staff that the values of properties have also declined, and that $6 billion have come off the property tax rolls since the passage of Measure 5. Furthermore, the state share of school funding has declined from a 48% share just in 2003 to, in the governor's recommended budget, a 37% level. School funding has declined at both the state and local levels precipitously over time, and we are the investment strategy of the state of Oregon with respect to those three things that the general fund does underwrite, education, health care, and human services, and public safety. So in these times when resources are so scarce, this is a very modest lifeline, and we'd like to say that just by taking properties out of compression, as Representative Gelser has pointed out, nearly $100 million a year becomes available immediately. And that $200 million in the next biennium, just to give you a little quick math, is the equivalent of 2,137 teaching jobs. So with that, I'd be happy to take your questions.
Questions for Lori? Nope, that side. By the way, for those who don't understand, some of our members are out being proponents of their own bills in other committees is the in and out for those who may not understand our process. Thank you, Lori. Holly?
Yes. Chairs Barnhart and Berger, my name is Holly Feifeld, and you'll have to bear with me. This is only my second time giving testimony, so please. I'm the Salem Kaiser organizer with Stand for Children, and we're here to testify in support of HJR 14. We greatly appreciate Representative Gelser's work to draft and champion this measure, and all of you for taking the time to discuss it. So Stand for Children supports HJR 14 because Oregon schools are simply underfunded. In the 20 years since Oregonians passed ballot Measure 5, public schools across the state have faced a steady decline in funding. During this time, students have faced decreased class sizes, shortened school years, and lost elective programs. Here in Salem-Kaiser, our budget has declined by about a third in the last few years, taking us back to funding levels of 2005. And during this time, and we've cut programs, we've cut people, and the stories are similar in districts across the state. Now is the time to ask the voting public to modify the original law and begin to update our property tax system for the 21st century. Time and again, Oregonians list public schools at the top or near the top of their priority list for public services that are important to them and that they'd like to see funded. Yet, statewide initiatives have severely hampered our goal to adequately fund education. I don't believe cutting funding for schools was the intent of voters when they passed these initiatives, but it has been the result. HJR 14 is a step toward restoring reasonable class sizes, full school years, and robust elective offerings. If the legislature sends this initiative to voters and voters pass it, it would allow local communities to decide whether they want to reinvest in their schools. And we know that many communities are eager to take advantage of this. Thank you.
Thank you. Very nice, Holly. Any questions for Holly? No. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have Mr. Barnhart has spoken that he would like to come forward. Is there anyone else come forward? Is there anyone else out there who wants to speak on this? Now is your chance. Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Hadn't planned to actually say anything. My name is T.A. Barnhart. I live in Portland. I'm in Representative Bailey's district. Prior to that, Sarah Gelser was my representative, so I'm pretty happy about government I've had in Oregon. In 2000, my kids, with my ex-wife and her husband, moved to Corvallis, and they finished out their school time in Corvallis. And it came a big surprise to me to hear from Representative Gelser that we were living in one of the most well-to-do districts in the state, because all I saw was year after year, cut after cut, days, weeks eventually lost from my kids' education. And the fact is that this country is one of the least taxed countries in the world. It seems high in difficult times, and there's a lot of reasons for that. Being the lefty I am, I blame, you know, corporations and rich people, of course. But the fact of the matter is, my kids were robbed of a decent education by this state, by people who voted for Measure 5, by people who refused to hold corporations accountable to pay their fair share. Homeowners used to only pay a third of the property tax burden in the state. They now pay two-thirds, not because theirs went up so much, because corporations went down thanks to Measure 5. This is, like Lori Wimmer said, a modest proposal. It restores local accountability. It gives some districts a chance to do a little something. Representative Barnhart's right. Doesn't fix it. It does help some districts a little bit. Our schools aren't broken. The educators and administrators in Corvallis, dedicated, wonderful people. My younger son, Jesse, is in the Coast Guard now. 4 years in the school band. It was one of the greatest things to happen to him. The school budget, the budget for the band was $800. Ridiculous. You can't buy music. So we started, you know, I co-founded Friends of CHS Band, just to do something. It's in this line that I see Representative Gelser's proposal. I would love to see this sent to the voters to at least talk about. We need to talk about it. Hopefully we can get past some of the really bad stuff that Representative Wand was talking about. It's ridiculous to be attacked without any basis on the issue. So I hope you will end up forwarding this to the House to vote on, so that the voters can have a chance to talk about a small fix, so other kids don't have to have their education taken away from them the way that my kids were. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barnhart. Any questions? Thank you for coming. I'm going to...
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just before we break, I wanted to comment on a couple of things that have been said about the issue. And I would say that the man I refer to as Cousin T.A., although I don't know that we're actually related, has spoken about my frustration very well today. I don't talk about it very often because I get tired of hearing myself repeat it over and over again. The second thing I want to note is that the complications of our current tax system, as this committee very well knows, were not imposed by the legislature. They came about as a result of initiatives that were voted on by the people, and the wild complexity and the difficulty of understanding the current system that we use to laughingly support public schools, because we don't really support public schools. It came about as a result of these initiatives. I agree with part of what Mr. Gates said, that the best thing we could do is simply to get rid of the complexity. He didn't say this, but I will. It would be great if we could go back to the system of property taxes that we used before Measure 5. Those were systems that were logical, rational, reasonable, easy to understand, flexible to deal with current economic conditions, changes in property values, fair, because properties of the same value in the same district were taxed the same way, and under the control of the people, because most of the budgets had to be, at least in growing communities, had to be adopted by votes of the people anyway. They did have some problems, and that can be dealt with pretty easily through the current equalization system that the legislature devised in the 90s. Now, do I think that's actually going to happen? No, I don't think it's going to happen. Doesn't mean I can't wish for it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. To be continued. We will have further discussion on this, and I appreciate all of your comments from all sides of this issue. Trust me. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on HJR 14, and I am going to open, committee members, a work session on House Bill 3017. It has come to my attention, members of the committee, that we may be awaiting fiscal on this, but we do have amendments. Christine, you want to?
Madam Chair, before she begins, there's a dash 2, which I think refers to prevailing wage issues, and it wasn't. I don't believe that it's the intention to work that one today.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair. House Bill 3017, with the dash 1 amendment, would extend the sunset date for Enterprise Zones from June 30th, 2013 to June 30th, 2025. The House Bill 3017 would actually extend the sunset date on long-term rural enterprise zones, as well as the property tax credits on long-term rural enterprise zones, as well as the income tax credits related to long-term rural enterprise zones. And the difference between House Bill 3017 and House Bill 3017 with the dash 1 amendment would be that the dash 1 amendment does not extend the sunset on the long-term rural enterprise zones income tax credit, but it does extend the sunset on the property tax credit. The revenue impact of the bill would begin to be realized in 2013-15 biennium, and it would be a portion of $62.1 million to counties and local taxing districts, as well as some impact on the general fund from the income tax credits. The dash 1 amendment would not impact the general fund because those income tax credits would be allowed to sunset for long-term rural enterprise zones.
Thank you. Representative Bailey is the sponsor. Would you like to speak to the amendments in the bill, please?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and I want to extend my appreciation to the members of this committee for the work on this bill, as well as to Representative Conger, who, as you may recall, testified on a very similar bill and has signed on along with some of those co-sponsors onto this bill as the vehicle. With the Dash 1 amendment, it accomplishes several things. One, by removing the long-term rural enterprise zone, it ensures that we don't preempt or jump the line on the process with the income tax credits that have been scheduled for sunset and review in the policy committee that Representative Reed and Representative Bentz chair. That particular credit is under review and has a separate vehicle for it. It also avoids any potential for a small general fund impact from that particular credit, and it also then makes 3017 essentially a hybrid between Representative Conger's bill and the bill that Representative Comp and I brought forward, and is a blend of those two bills.
Representative Wand.
What is a long-term rural enterprise zone? What's that definition?
Madam Chair, Representative Wand, a long-term rural enterprise zone is a designation of enterprise zone in which could be applied in rural counties that would allow a longer period of tax exemption. The standard tax exemption in a standard enterprise zone is 3 to 5 years, with depending on the agreement with the sponsor. In a long-term rural enterprise zone, the period of exemption can go from 7 to 15 years. So it simply allows for a longer period of exemption, and it has an income tax credit associated with it as well.
So it's a property tax credit and an income exemption and an income tax credit.
Follow up?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just so that I'm clear, if we pass the Dash 1 amendment, the long-term rural enterprise zone tax credit will not die. It will be revisited in another bill as part of the tax credit committee. So this is not a final decision. This isn't our final answer, so to speak, on the issue.
Right. That's exactly right.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions?
Representative Bailey.
Madam Co-Chair, I would move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3017.
Representative Bailey moves that Dash 1 amendment be added to House Bill 3017. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. It is my understanding that we cannot move the bill because we do not have the fiscal. Okay, so we will again, without any further amending, we now have the bill. We will get the paperwork, and I will carry this over until tomorrow, members of the committee.
Okay.
With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3017, and I'm going to open a work session on House 2075. Members of the committee, this is a bill that I think you're all familiar with. It has to do with telecommunications and the complexities of ways that telecommunication is offered and how it relates to how we fund our 911 services using monthly telephone charge on our monthly telephone bill. It is certainly true that telecommunications gets more complicated, and that's maybe one of the things that we always say, how come taxes are so complex? Maybe this is a classic example of how things get very complex. It is, Representative Wand was charged with looking at this with the proponents and folks who have been pretty clear that of the difficulties of this, there's been much discussion about this. Today we are in work session. We are not in public hearing, but I would like to hear from both the proponents and those who have believed that this particular vehicle is perhaps not the one that's going to get us there. Mazin, do you have anything that needs to be added to this discussion from staff perspective before I invite folks up?
No, not particularly, Madam Chair. Just this is an appropriate day for the Fighting Irish, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. We have had amendments to the original bill. Because it is frankly not my intention to move the bill today, I'm not particularly interested in entertaining those amendments. But I would like Elise Brown and Richard Kosasan and who else have we got? Is Brian DeLashmit? Drew Hagedorn. There's four. We'll get four up here. These folks are representatives of the cell phone companies. And it is, and I believe they can speak to it, their desire to have a further ongoing discussion about this. And I've asked them to come forward and explain how they think that would work rather than moving this particular proposal forward. So if you, one or all.
Richard Kosasan, Verizon Wireless. Madam Chair, with the continuation of discussions, I think it's become very clear that the actual implementation of the collection of this new tax is rather difficult and cumbersome. And the primary reason for that is we have five states maintaining no sales tax, and that would be Alaska, Delaware, New Hampshire, Montana, and Oregon. So if there was a point of sale collection mechanism,
through a sales tax, the collection probably would be much easier. So, absent of that, I think the providers would very much and sincerely appreciate an opportunity to develop a system that provides for an effective, efficient, viable method of collection of the new tax. In terms of equity, Verizon Wireless, I will not speak for the other individuals here, believes it represents an equity issue. If one entity pays into the 911 system, we should find a mechanism that all pay. But in light of those other states, in light of the need for the industry to craft something, additional time would be very much and sincerely appreciated.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Elise Brown on behalf of AT&T and also on my other AT&T colleagues, John Powell and John C. Powell. First of all, I wanted to thank Representative Wand for the extra time he spent in working with a large stakeholder group and I'm sure understanding the complexity of the issue, and we do appreciate his time. And just on behalf of AT&T, we are committed to working on a solution that's fair and equitable for all prepaid customers. Thanks.
And I guess I would like to understand that commitment means a time frame that is working on something isn't getting it done. And I think that I would like to hear that that a proposal will be brought back to it at the very least, if we can't get to it during this session, during the February session, that some proposals would come forward for that body. Is that something we can agree on?
Madam Chair, Richard Kosasan again. And yes, I think all four of us here realize that there is a desire to move forward, and we are committed to work on an equitable solution during the interim for preparation for next February.
For the record, Brian DeLeichmann representing Sprint Nextel. I'll just echo the sentiments of what you've heard. We have committed. Sprint has been very clear in its direction to me that this is not an effort to stall, but it's an effort to figure out what is the most logical, equitable way to deal with this, and we are committed to a time frame, and I've told my folks that we have a limited amount of time that we need to solve this. I'll put on a different hat. I also represent public safety officers as well. Public safety has an interest in this as well. And so from just two different perspectives, I'm very committed to getting this done. Thank you.
Drew Hagedorn for T-Mobile USA. Again, echoing what everyone else said, our company is committed to addressing this issue. I think we also want to bring to bear some of our resources nationally from our CTIA, our National Industry Association, so we can get some experts at the table to help us craft a solution that's workable for the non-sales tax state. So T-Mobile also is committed, and we appreciate the opportunity to discuss this with the committee, with Representative Wan, Representative Berger, and others. So thank you very much.
Yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I want to echo the comments that our co-chair made here. We in this body, and for those listening at home, may not have the benefit of seeing all the testimony that we get all the time. But there is a common code that comes forward in testimony where the commitment to work on an issue is sometimes a stall tactic or a tactic to avoid an issue. Now, Mr. DeLeichmann, I take you at your word that that is not the intention, and I take the rest of you at your word that that is not the intention here. But I want to make sure that there is an understanding here. I heard from Mr. Kosasan that he understands that there is a desire to move forward on this. What I think everybody needs to understand is that there is an urgency to move forward on this. Just very recently, we had reverse 911 calls to residents on the coast to evacuate from a tsunami. More than ever, right now, the need is apparent. We have to have well-funded services. We have to ensure that our communities are safe. And now, more than ever, is the opportunity to show that this has to happen now. So what I want to hear is an understanding that this has to happen.
Richard Kosasan,
Representative Bailey, I think four of us are sitting before you, and I think we've heard the message very directly, very clearly, very succinctly. We've definitely heard exactly what you're saying, feel the same way. Again, I think all four of us would concur. First and foremost, it's an equity issue. That is, I think, the primary issue. But we need to develop a very good, effective, viable, and efficient mechanism to make it work in the real world, and we're committed to do that.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Bailey, obviously I was the one that answered the question about the commitment, and quite frankly, my reputation is on the line here, and I've made that commitment, and my company understands that commitment and has historically backed me on those kinds of commitments. So I'm personally committed to making this happen. Thank you.
Representative Perkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I'm not convinced that given all the different constraints around collection issues and all of that, that a solution can be found that everybody's going to be happy with or excited about or believed to be the magic silver bullet that solves all problems. But I am convinced that the 911 system in Oregon needs the infusion of resources, and that this is a place where we need to get those resources. I certainly understand the discussion, the desire to deal with equity as an issue, but the resource issue is also exceedingly important for us. When I say that, when I make the comment I make about not necessarily expecting you to find the ideal silver bullet solution, we need a solution that that will result in the infusion of those funds to for the purpose that we've described, whether it's an ideal solution or not. And I'm assuming that as you describe the work that you're going to do with the five states, that you may not like the solution that you come up with, but that you'll support it and help it to move forward by February, whether it is a silver bullet or something a little grayer and a little less popular with your in an ideal sense.
Yes.
Yes.
Anyone like to respond to that? Yes would do.
Yes.
Yes.
Madam Co-Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, wholeheartedly agree. I think the trick in part of this debate is the institution of the new tax to assure that it is uniform and the new tax is applied in a uniform manner to the subscriber since the inception of the program. The incidence of the tax and the tax liability has clearly been on the subscriber. And that would be, I think, my first personal goal, and find a uniform way in which we can accomplish that goal.
Madam Chair, I have to leave to go testify in another committee. My leaving has nothing to do with this discussion.
Thank you, Mr.
Madam Co-Chair and Co-Chair who's leaving, obviously I think one of the other goals as we've looked around the other states is to maximize the resources that come in as well. And so when you look at a state like Maine, which went down the path similar to the bill that you have before you and decided that they were not generating the revenue that they expected and then went in a different path and found that they were generating about three times as much revenue, I think that's one of our goals, too, is the equity issue, but also making sure that you are, in fact, able to collect the revenue that you believe you're going to collect, and it does support the system.
Representative Reed and then Representative Burr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the conversation that's already gone on, particularly Representative Bailey's reminder of the importance of the 911 system and the comments that various of you made about equity. For me, equity is important. I take perhaps a slightly different connotation to that word at the moment, thinking about the fact that all of us who have phones of whatever type are able to call 911, but not all of us are contributing to that system. Recognizing that your request and proposal is to have more time to talk about solutions, I wonder if you could give us some of a preview of some of the other options, some of the non-point of sale options that you would be likely to consider if you had more time, as a way of allowing the committee to think about those things. Again, sort of recognizing the complexity that we've all talked about. If you're able to come up with something, we're likely to want to have a chance to consider that, perhaps with some detail in advance.
Do you have that?
I'll make a first stab at it. But I think as Madam Co-Chair and Representative Reed, Representative Juan could help with the exercise, I think, of two long and arduous, drawn-out discussions. The perfect solution, I don't think, was readily apparent. But there, to me, there needs to be a mechanism in place to find the avenue through which the provider, and in today's system, the provider's responsibility is basically to collect and remit the tax from the subscriber. So if we can craft a solution that functions to serve in a manner allowing the provider to collect in an efficient manner the tax from the prepaid customer, to me, that's the perfect solution that we're looking for.
May I follow up?
Yes.
Thank you. I think that helped a little bit. I wonder if there's any more specifics that you might offer as options that are under consideration, recognizing that there's more discussion to be had, not holding you to a commitment to any of them, but could you give us some of the things that a group might continue to discuss?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Reed, probably not right now. I think it does take, and I think it's going to take some concerted effort on the provider's part, as well as the advocates, the proponents part, as well as everybody else with an interest in this issue to truly sit down and craft a viable mechanism.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Reed, I think there's one component that became very apparent as we were going through this discussion, which is one party or one large party was not at the table at this point, and that was the retailers. And so, obviously, a discussion is going to have to occur not only between the proponents of collecting the tax, and I would actually put us in that category as proponents of collecting the tax, but also what are the mechanisms that you can capture that tax and what part the retailers are going to play in that. So I would say there's one component, without giving you a solution up front, I think there was a party that was missing from the discussion to this point. And hopefully we can incorporate them in our discussion. And whether it's point of sale or some unknown solution, I think there's one major party that was missing at this point. And we hope to incorporate them and have a discussion.
One final comment, Madam Chair. Yes. Thank you. I appreciate that again. I must say that given the urgency of the issue, given the length of our discussion so far, it's disappointing to me to hear that you have not yet identified any specific things to consider. I know that there's work to be done, but I would hope that I'm disappointed that that hasn't happened already, but I would hope that you'd be back to us very soon with specific options, at the very least, for consideration. It's not encouraging here sitting here to hear, we'd like more time, trust us. We don't have any ideas yet, but we'll do it.
Madam Co-Chair, that's not, with all due respect, that's not accurate. There are multiple options. Multiple options at various levels. Every single option has attached to it a fixed cost or a substantial political barrier that we have to work through. And to give you a prime example, if we go forward with a model that does not allow for the industry to charge the money directly to the customer, there's a political problem with that because this is a program that was always paid for directly by the subscriber. That is the model that we have been under. And if we make that change, it is a sea change in the way that we are advocating for this program.
A second example is the point-of-sale model. The point-of-sale model has substantial political problems because it looks and smells and feels like a sales tax. The third instance is the decrement model. The decrement model is what's before us today. That also has a substantial barrier because it is a cost that will be spread over to all of the postpaid customers. So those are three examples of equally bad choices, and they're asking for time to work through those three examples of equally bad choices to try to come up with the best, least bad choice. So it's just, I mean, with respect, it's just not accurate to say there aren't options.
Representative Wan, I appreciate it, and Representative Reed, and I think this may be a discussion that I want to hear from these folks rather than engage us in further, because there's plenty of controversy, but go ahead.
Madam Chair, that's perfectly fine, and I take the good point from Representative Wan. I just didn't hear that discussion from the panelists. That's my only point.
Yes.
And Madam Co-Chair and Representative Reed, again, I would concur with Representative Wan's. There's some downsides to each alternative that we looked at. So I think the industry needs a little bit of time to say, can we come up with a better solution that fits in Oregon as well as your other four remaining non-sales tax states? And I think the industry is very, very committed to directly address that issue.
Representative Brewer, did you have something to add here? I'm going to make a final comment, and we're going to move on.
Okay, well, I kind of have a final comment and observation. We are bearing down quite heavy on this industry with great intensity and expressing some urgency to fix this because 911 is in the shortage of funds. But it boggles my mind how the legislature has repeatedly swept the 911 funds if there is this great sense of urgency. So to the extent that we're bearing down this intensity upon this industry, perhaps we should bear it down upon ourselves as well. And it just really, when you talk about equity, we have ratepayers of the current 911 fees that have inequitably subsidized the general fund. How many times have we swept it? And so I believe it is not intellectually honest to just discuss the inequity between phone users currently paying and phone users not, without also talking about the magnitude of amounts of money that should be paid, and those that in fact do pay it, we turn that into a tax. And it actually, to be honest, kind of angers me a bit. It's where is our responsibility as legislators? And so yes, you do have some work to do as an industry and to come back and do that. But we also must be true to our own words and to the current ratepayers. And that's what I want to say.
Thank you, Representative Brewer. Thank you for coming forward. I understand that you nobody likes a tax. Believe me, the subscribers don't like the tax. We don't like it either. The fact of the matter is, however, some are paying and some are not for a service that we all share, and it is because of the difficulty of the technology that we can't get to something immediately. Not, I believe, because you folks aren't understanding of that fundamental equity issue. And are you in agreement with that? And so in going forward, we're all on the same page of getting to something, and it may not be the most popular thing in the world. I have yet to meet that popular tax, okay? But I'm sure it's out there somewhere. Just haven't seen it. And so popularity is not what we're looking at. We're looking for workability and equity. And to that end, we're all committed to go forward on that. Is that, do I get nods and yeses
yes.
on that? Okay, with that, thank you very much. I would like to hear from General Caldwell and Hasina Squires. They have been on the sort of the other side of that. This is this bill came from originally from General Caldwell, and with respect to his and Kevin Campbell, would you like to come forward too and speak to how we're going to get there?
Thank you, Chair Berger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. Obviously, we've been in many of your offices for many long hours discussing this bill, and so I want to begin by saying that we appreciate that time. We know this has been a complicated issue. I would be lying if I didn't say I was greatly disappointed that we're here today having to continue a discussion my primary reason for disappointment has most to do with not my the lobbyists who are currently advocating on behalf of their clients, because I interact with them every day and like them, know them, will work with them again on other issues. My concern is that this issue of the inequity did not begin with the beginning of the session. These companies did not enter this market without an understanding of these phones, the fact that they would be accessing 911, and that this would be a discussion. Other companies have made the adjustment voluntarily, have come forward to figure out how to pay the tax. These folks are just now saying they need more time. I find that disappointing. I hope you would find it disappointing also. Nonetheless, I make that point and leave it there. I would say also that I agree, Representative Erbrewer, about the issue of sweeps. We don't like the sweeps. We've argued against the sweeps. We are not just bearing down on this industry. We do have a bill that does bear down on the legislature with regard to this. It's in the House Judiciary Committee, and we hope that you will all vote for it. It is one of the few dedicated funds that I think the public has a strong expectation that those dollars will be going to the purpose for which they're collected, and I support that. But I believe that's a separate issue, and it's a separate bill, and today we're sitting here talking about an inequity. I'm not here because of the inequity. I'm here because there are dollars that should be going and should be paid and going to the 911 system that are not going there. And it is not a system that's flush with money. My police chiefs, their departments, fire departments, are paying more every year in their user fees for 911. So money that doesn't go there from here, they make up locally. And so I am concerned about that. And I do appreciate this committee's commitment to work on this bill. I'm disappointed, but I have no doubt in your commitment to get this done. Thank you for letting me be straightforward and blunt on those points. I do appreciate all your work, and I hope we'll continue to have this conversation.
Thank you,
Kevin.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department and the Interim Director of the Office of Emergency Management. And I echo what Kevin said. I think as we look at this whole entire issue, there's no question that it's an equity discussion. I'm disappointed. We met three, four different times, looked at numerous different opportunities or schemes or mechanisms to try to resolve the problem. We certainly didn't want to make it a heavy-handed situation. We want to work with these folks because we're all partners in this public safety operation. I understand why they probably want some more time, but I can tell you right now from my perspective, there aren't any other ideas out there. And so you've got three, maybe four bad choices that was echoed, I think, by Representative Wand. And I, for the life of me, can't figure out what more time is going to buy us other than more time, because there are only so many ways to come at this thing. You can only eat this elephant at a certain way. And folks, you know, if there's another one out there, show us. You know, if there is another idea out there that somebody hasn't thought of, we have examined every single state. We've had conversations. We've looked at every bit of data we can find. And there's just simply only so many mechanisms. So we can wait till February. And then in February, we're going to be back here, and they're going to say, well, we did it again, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 meetings, and we still don't have an answer. So at some point, we're either going to collect it or we're not. And just one of the comments by somebody here this morning about what happened this last week on the coast. My night started at 10 o'clock, 2200 in our language. And we, by 1 o'clock, I was in the EOC, and stayed there until the next 26, 27 hours. What we learned was in Curry County, which is one of the more lowly funded 911 PSAP operations in the state, that the 911 reverse 911 didn't work. Now, we were down there on Saturday with the governor. We were down there with Senator Merkley, and the governor and I went down. And they're trying to figure out the glitch. I asked them, I said, well, how much do you put in local to your operation? And the sheriff said, not a lot, because we don't have a lot. We're one of the poorer counties in Oregon. And they are. Curry County's taken a real hit. And they probably, he said, somewhere around 30%. That's almost reverse of what you'll find in this county. It's 70% local money, 30% state money. Down there, 70% state, 30% local. Now, that has an impact on how we warn people. That has an impact on how we take care of people in this state. So I think it's a legitimate concern. It deserves to be brought to the forefront. It deserves to be dealt with now, not in February. And I would highly recommend it. I got all the time in the world. I'll stop what I'm doing, and I'll meet every day with these guys if that's what it takes. And my staff will do the same, because I got a lot of time on my hand right now. I'm only doing two jobs. I can do at least three more.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Okay? So I appreciate the committee's interest. I appreciate the committee's work on it. I think there's clearly a way out of this thing. I don't know what it is right yet, but I think we should work hard to find that and do it now, not later.
Thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of APCO NENA, the Oregon chapter. When we last left this party, the party that we had during the first hearing, it was clear from my perspective that this committee was saying, bring us some other options. They're not point of sale. We're not interested in passing a sales tax. I believe it was Representative Juan that said he didn't come to Salem to pass a sales tax. Yet what I keep hearing from the industry is point of sale. Brian DeLashmit just said, the big people that weren't in the room were the retailers. That's point of sale. So I feel like I would be remiss in not clearly explaining the two methods that are in the bill that we believe the industry could implement today if you did pass this bill. And the other two options that during those discussions we brought forward that were not point of sale options, that were not agreed upon. The first is the decrement approach. Representative Juan, with all due respect, the decrement approach would not be spread onto postpaid customers. It's prepaid only, and it's implemented in 12 other states. Also in the bill is a method called the ARPU method, average revenue per user method. And how it would work is that a company that was providing prepaid cellular phone service would take their total intrastate revenue, and they would take, then the industry would tell Department of Revenue what the average revenue is per customer. An industry standard is about $50. They can set it at $40, they can set it at $20. They get to determine what the average revenue is per customer. They would take that total intrastate revenue, divide it by that number. Let's say in this example, it's 50. Then they would determine how many prepaid customers they have. Members of the committee, these companies know how many prepaid customers they have. They know how many are prepaid, and they know how many are not. It's a simple mathematical calculation at that point. It is not something that cannot be overcome. You would then multiply that by the 75 cents, and you would remit the tax in one large chunk. Yes, it would not be paid by the subscriber, but you're capable of collecting that tax and remitting it in that method. Secondly, we brought forward, or thirdly, excuse me, a third option. So those two are in the bill currently today. Third option, incorporate some sort of method where it is determined how the prepaid phone it would be identified for this issue of location of use. Who's using this phone? We have heard from industry. We don't know where these phones are located. We don't know who's using them. There are cards and they're activated. Zip codes, zip code, prepaid activation. That was one of our suggestions. Fourth, phone numbers are all assigned to prepaid phones. A phone number, a simple phone number that has an area code. An area code located in Oregon. An area code that we all know, that's an Oregon area code. Then when the number is activated, the tax is remitted. That was another option, another hybrid option. So from our perspective, from the public safety perspective, we're full of ideas. We're full of lots of ideas that are not point-of-sale options, that are not bringing retailers into the state, into this conversation, that are not coming forward to you and asking you to implement what would be a sales tax. We've got many options that are not sales tax options. And we would agree with General Caldwell and the police chiefs that why not now? What will be different? What is it that cannot be implemented in any of those four options? I don't think that this committee, and certainly not in any of our discussions, do we hear the technical data about why this, at least the second method in the bill, could not be implemented. That'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee or comments from the committee? Well, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Let me, committee members, explain a little difficulty that I have here. Under ordinary budget circumstances, I would be ordering up a task force and putting together specific staff and specific members of this committee to go forth and be at the table. We are in a terrible budget crunch, and it is difficult for me to spend money in this way when we've got so many other needs. So it is my intention to be dedicated to this issue on a kind of a personal level, and to be monitoring any meetings and to disseminate to you through any email my thoughts, notes, and anything that comes forward from now forward on this issue. You know and I know that only legislative meetings are remunerated in this way, but I can tell you I have time, and I will be very, very interested in the way this progresses. And I will keep you closely in the loop for any information that I get, and so that we are prepared to move on this quickly when the opportunity presents itself. Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for this hearing. I don't think it could possibly be any more clear the seriousness with which this committee is taking this issue and the desire to move forward on it. And I would just add for the record that I certainly would not want to be in the position of disappointing you. And so I assume that those in the room that are engaged in this also would like to avoid that situation. And so
I can assure you I've been disappointed before, but in this case I will not be.
I would not want to disappoint you.
We will succeed. Thank you very much, members of the committee, and I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2075 and quickly move to open a public hearing on House Bill 2567. Chris, would you please describe this for us in the hurry that you've got?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2567 would disallow personal income and corporate taxpayers from claiming any tax credits between tax years 2011 and 2013 unless certain economic conditions are met. The bill would require on a date later than January 1, 2013, that a majority of each House of the Assembly find that at least one of the following economic conditions exists, and there are three of them. The first one would be the last revenue forecast for the 13-15 biennium would indicate that the revenue for that biennium will be at least 5% greater than the general fund appropriations for the 11-13 biennium. Or two, that there has been an increase in the non-farm payroll employment for at least two consecutive quarters beginning after June 30th, 2012. Or a revenue forecast projects that the general fund revenue for the 11-13 biennium will be at least 2% above the projected revenues as reported in the May 11 forecast. That'll be the next forecast that you get. And it would prohibit taxpayers from claiming any of the suspending credits before January 1, 2014.
Questions for Chris? I think it's, are those conditions met?
If they're met, then
tax credits.
They could be claimed. It would be, given the language of the bill, it would be either through amended returns or carry forwards after January 1, 2014.
Okay, questions of Chris?
No.
Yes.
Thank you. Does this mean that the credit would never be available then? Under this bill, or that it would be postponed until a later time?
If the, Co-Chair Barnhart, if the conditions are met, they would just be, they're temporarily suspended. They could be claimed in 2014. It doesn't specify a mechanism, but the, as I read it, the way the taxpayers could claim that would be then to file amended returns for those years. So if one of the, assuming one of the conditions is met, then in the spring of 2014, taxpayers, could be in a position of filing multiple tax year returns. They'd be filing for 2013, that's the filing time, and then they could file amended returns for 11 and 12 if the credits were suspended.
Okay, so if I could follow up.
Yes.
Because we're on a cash flow basis, that would deal with revenue issues for 11-13.
It would essentially push the claiming of the usage of the credits from the 11-13 biennium to the 13-15 biennium.
Right. Thank you.
Further questions? Do we have?
I can ask my question staff or wait if someone's coming up.
I don't believe anyone has signed up, so now's your chance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. Just looking at a quick read of this, it's kind of an odd thing because it talks about for tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2011, and before January 1st, 2014. It applies to both individuals and corporations, what I seem to recall. But it says for those years you can't claim a credit against taxes due, not tax liability, but taxes due, which is an odd term of art, which talks about cash flow rather than liability. And for taxes due on a date later than January 1st, 2013. And so it's really an odd thing. 2011 taxes would be due in 2011 and 12, and due is different based on estimated taxes versus liability. So this, to me, I see a conflict here between application of credit, which is done at filing deadline versus tax payment is done as the year goes on for estimated taxpayers and withholdings. And so there's this law to me is this bill is faultily written. And I'm not sure what the goal of this is, but if it is a legitimate goal, it needs to be fixed.
I think there are technical issues with the language there. I was trying to convey the intent and the policy intent. Okay.
Representative Warren.
Two questions. A technical question. Does this intend to include the mortgage interest deduction?
No, these are just tax credits. That's
just the tax credits.
Just tax not credits. Yet.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Madam
questions
Chair.
Questions or comments?
Well, if I may, Madam Chair, I don't remember where this bill came from, and it was introduced by the committee, by the Interim Committee. But it's apparent that it's intended to deal with cash flow issues, and probably in the hopes that the economy is in recovery and the revenues are up for 13-15. It seems really unlikely that the committee would act on a bill like this unless it became part of the end game on the budget. For that reason, it might be useful at least to get a ballpark estimate of what the revenue impact would be for the biennium. I don't know that we want to spend a lot of time on it, but some, so we could get some sense of what kind of dollars we're talking about, you know, what the order of magnitude is, and a look at least the issue raised by Representative Brewer about the technical problem of mixing definitions. In the event that in May or early June, the Ways and Means situation leads us to want to do something with it. That's my suggestion.
Okay. It has been my experience that asking for a ballpark figure from economists is oxymoronic.
Well, in a way.
But their reputations depend, and I understand what you're asking for here, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of teasing economists. It's easy to do.
yes.
And kind of fun. I'm not opposing your suggestion at all. How about a ballpark, Chris?
yeah.
But I do think that if we are going to consider this, we also need to seriously consider technical language here because I think it's far off. I think Representative Brewer is absolutely correct on that.
Well, if I may, that you have to have the technical language fixed before you can do the ballpark.
But I think Chris was speaking to intent.
That to that point, there is the ballpark for the policy, the intended policy, and then the ballpark for the drafted language. And so I can be clear about that. So if an estimate were tied to the language as specifically written in 2567, that's a little bit different from the policy intent.
I think the policy intent.
Right.
Yeah.
Further questions, comments? We have no one signed up to rush up and talk about this bill. So I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2567 and adjourn today's Revenue Committee. Thank you very, very much.